John DeGraff, and this is, I think, my eighth summer teaching at Holden in the past 10 years or so. But I haven't been here the past 2 years, so this is nice to be back again in Holden for me. My background is as a documentary filmmaker, and I work as a freelance documentary filmmaker at the Seattle PBS affiliate, KCTS TV in Seattle. I actually started out in television. For some of you Midwesterners, I started out at KTCA in St. Paul, so in my documentary career, but that was about 33 years ago, so it's a while since I've lived in the Twin Cities, and have, over that period of time, made, I think, about somewhere around 40 documentaries for public television in various ways. But when I made a film, which we will show here for those of you who haven't seen it, I know always that there are people who have seen it, but when I made a film called Affluenza in the late 1990s, 1997, I started getting actually invited to speak about the film, the subject and things, and I got kind of much more to become an activist around the things that my films were saying, and much more involved in the issues themselves. And in 2002, I started a nonprofit organization called Take Back Your Time, which I've talked about at different times here at Holden. You can find that on the web at timeday.org. And that's an organization that explores what I would call America's epidemic of overwork and time pressure, time poverty, and the impact of how much we work in comparison to other industrial countries, for example, on our health and on a variety of things. As I was talking about that issue, about the time issue, I noticed that I would consistently sort of get this question, but if we didn't work so much, if we shortened the work week, or if we had the amount of vacation time, for example, that is simply taken for granted anywhere in Europe, what would that do to the economy? This was always the question. What will that do to the economy? And it was almost the sense that the economy called all the shots. And Thomas Pynchon in Gravity's Rainbow raises an interesting point in which he says that if you can get people asking the wrong questions, you don't have to worry about the answers. And I would argue that what will that do to the economy is, at least in the beginning, the wrong question, and that the real question we need to ask is a question, what's the economy for anyway? What's it all about? Why are we doing what we're doing? Why do we want to do these things? And so I started talking about that and ended up creating a little slightly humorous talk that I went around and gave called What's the Economy For Anyway? And at one point, surprise, surprise, because I am not an economist, although I play one on TV, but I am not a trained economist. I took one economics course at the University of Berkeley, that was it, University of California. But I've studied a lot of economics over the years in making my films, and so I had the audacity to give this little talk, What's the Economy For Anyway? And at one point I was invited to give that talk to a room full of PhD economists. And you can imagine that this was a little daunting. This actually took place at the Rockefeller Estate in Tarrytown, New York. Here I was in this room with all these economists, fully expecting to be driven out of the estate and, if not drowned in the Hudson River, at least driven away from the place where I was speaking. But lo and behold, they liked it. They liked the talk. They, of course, said, well, it's simplistic and it's superficial and there's a mistake here, a mistake there, so forth and so on. Academics do this. But they liked it, and they said, you know, what we like about it is that it's engaging. It will engage students. It will get students to ask questions and to think. And what we want to do for you is to find you enough money so that you can refine this and you can do other things with it. And develop it even as a curriculum for courses and other things. And so they did that. They got me a very nice grant from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund to develop the idea to teach a course, a summer course at the University of Washington on the subject, in which my students and my fellow faculty and I developed a website that you can find. It's called citizeneconomy.org. That will give you a lot of the data and the information that what I have to say comes from. And I admit to having this terrible sickness. I'm sort of addicted to data and to looking at obscure things like the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development annual fact book and things like that compares countries around different economic and quality of life elements. And so we taught the class at UW, and then I was then invited to teach a similar class at the Evergreen State College in Olympia. Some of you may be familiar with Evergreen. It's a pretty loose institution, so they put up with people like me. So I've taught there before. And so I taught a class there. And we developed the idea further, gave some talks. We still had some money left. And so the economist said, well, you're a filmmaker. Why don't you make a film with this? And I felt like I wanted to have a film that would work for young people, for people brought up on Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. And so I kind of conceived this film as Al Gore meets Stephen Colbert. Not quite as wonkish as Al Gore, and certainly not as funny as Stephen Colbert, but hopefully somewhere in between with some information to get people thinking about some of the information, the issues that I was bringing up. The host of the film, his name is Dave Batker, and he is a real economist. He's actually certified, unlike me. And he is actually an ecological economist and runs a little organization called Earth Economics in Tacoma, Washington. Dave is a funny guy, and he is an economist, and he will be here this week. So he's going to come join us on Wednesday. He'll be arriving in the village, and then he'll do one of take most of Thursday evening session, which is about sustainability, and then we'll probably do the Friday session together. And we'll be showing the film in its entirety on Friday afternoon for people who don't want to get all this class stuff and just want to see the film. So, and I want to start just taking a couple of minutes and just ask you for anybody who's interested to sort of show your hand and tell me what you think the economy is for. I mean, why do we do it? What's it about? Anybody want to suggest a few things? We'll write your ideas up here on the whiteboard. And who wants to start?
What it's really for, or should be for?
Well, okay. Should be. Is. Okay, if you can choose either one, but anyway, let's just do this for a couple of minutes and get a few ideas out here, and then I'm going to show you the beginning of the film, and we'll have a bit of conversation about the first section of the film and some of my ideas about what I think you want to be for.
Bring order to our economy, your country.
Pardon?
Economy is to bring order to our country.
Bring order to the country?
Yeah.
That's what you should do?
Yeah.
Okay, bring order. Okay. Yes.
Is.
Yeah, it is.
To maximize profits for the wealthy.
Okay. Oh,
you got a point. Jay, we'll bring a point. Just not mess around here.
I think my old
son. Okay. So we got a should be and we got a is. How about a couple more should be?
Another is decide reduction and distribution of goods.
Yeah.
That's what it is?
Is, I guess.
Okay.
And services.
Okay. Besides distribution, okay.
Yeah.
Not much room here, but that's a basic idea. Anybody else? I believe it should be. Yes.
Well, it should be a snapshot in time.
An economy is a snapshot in time?
In time, yeah.
In time, okay. That's true. What is it a snapshot of?
Our choices.
Ah, okay. So it should be something that reflects our choices. Good. That's the word I was looking for. Reflects our choices. Okay. Should do that.
Should be family wage jobs.
Okay. So family wage jobs should be at least part of an economy. Okay, anybody else? Let's take a couple more. Either end, should be or is.
Something about productivity.
What about productivity?
Maybe it's a measure of productivity.
The economy is a measure of productivity, or it's a way we achieve productivity?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a means to productivity. Let's look at that. Productivity is a very interesting word. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about particularly tomorrow. Let's hear what we do a little earlier. Yes?
Right, it should be. The economy is a means for providing basic necessities to people and.
Okay. Means to provide necessities, okay. It isn't really a question we ask too often. We don't really hear it asked in our campaigns and things, you know. We just assume certain ideas about this is the economy, this is what it does, and is this good or bad for it? As if it's this thing almost unto itself, completely independent from us and from our choices and from our needs and desires. So, anyway, let me show you a little of this movie, which came out early this year and was liked well enough by Bloomsbury Press, which is Harry Potter's publisher. Dave and I now have a contract to write this as a book, so the book will be coming out next spring, published by Bloomsbury. But I'm going to start this, and then we're going to talk a little bit about particularly the last of four chapters that you're going to see here, the chapter on health and the connection between health and the economy. And then we'll talk a little bit more about how we measure progress and some of the new things we're going to have available to us very soon, thanks to, believe it or not, the health care bill. Oops, that's in the wrong way. Okay, babe.
What the lights?
Just a second. I've got a
27 choice.
Okay. Let's play.
Issue number one in the last election, sending Barack Obama to the White House with a mandate to fix it. It dominates conversation. Bailouts, food prices, foreclosures, credit squeeze, we're all in it together. I'm Dave Thacker. I'm just an ordinary American, like, you know, Joe the Plumber. I'm also an economist. I've worked for the World Bank. Oh, I've also worked for Greenpeace. And I want to talk to you about this economy everybody's talking about. What is it for anyway? When is it working? Can it work better? You've probably heard about how some people measure economic success. Wall Street checks its stocks. Are they up or down? The government checks inflation, unemployment, housing starts, consumer confidence. But the key of all economic measures is the GDP. That's shorthand for the gross domestic product. The grosser it gets, the better we assume the economy to be. But what is the GDP anyway?
The GDP is the total market value of all final goods and services produced in a country in a given year.
GDP measures what we made here this year and paid for. If we pay, then GDP goes up, unless we're paying for stuff made somewhere else. We buy a lot of that, but it doesn't count, at least not for us. There are other things that don't count either, like volunteering in my community. It's a waste of time as far as the GDP is concerned. So is that daily walk that I try to take. And the time I spend with my son. Unless I buy him stuff, that counts. Remember that big oil spill in Alaska? Made you want to cry, didn't it? But the GDP was laughing all the way to the bank. Because first, there was money spent to clean it up. Then those huge legal bills. The spill added more to the GDP than if the oil had made it safely to the refinery. Seriously. Maybe Bobby Kennedy said it best.
It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are American.
Once upon a time, our country had no idea how much stuff we made, and nobody cared. Until the Great Depression, when our government adopted national economic goals and needed a way of measuring their achievement. The economist Simon Kuznets laid out the GDP in 1934. During World War II, it was an important tool in measuring how many guns, tanks, and bombs we were building. Even then, Kuznets warned against making too much of his measure. But Kuznets is history, not the GDP, though. With all the attention it gets, you'd think boosting the GDP is what the economy is for. That's what a lot of economists will tell you, too.
The economy's purpose is to produce more and more goods and services.
Doesn't matter what they are. If money is spent on them, they must be goods. And the more of them, the better. What the consumer wants, the consumer gets. Economists call that consumer sovereignty. Buyer knows best. Case closed. Or is it? Actually, there's an American tradition that's older than the GDP. About 100 years ago, Gifford Pinchot became the first director of the U.S. Forest Service. He wasn't a wild-eyed radical. He was a Republican. Pinchot believed that the purpose of the economy was the greatest good, the greatest number, over the longest run. Think about it. Take the greatest good. What do you think that means?
The good life to me is having a job that's in your field that you're passionate about.
To me, family is very important.
And always having someone there to help you through hard times.
Having good health, nothing burning down financially, having everything stable.
It's all about quality of life, isn't it? Pursuit of happiness. Part of that. Stuff is part of that. But only part. Family, friends, health matter more. So how are we doing? Now we all know the United States is one humongous GDP. It's totally awesome, really. I mean, no one else comes close.
No!
What? Well, who cares about Luxembourg anyway? We're the Toys R Us of the world. We've got monster houses, luxury tanks, huge flat screen TVs.
Whoa.
So cool. We are number one, right? Let's check it out. See how we stack up with other rich countries. You know, apples to apples. Okay. You ready? Let's go. Let's start with babies. We love our babies, don't we? I'm not so sure. We're 42nd in the world when it comes to infant mortality.
Where'd you get that?
It's what the CIA says. Yes, you heard it right. The Central Intelligence Agency. 42nd. Now, we spend a lot on our kids. But compared to kids in other countries, we're a bit deprived. One thing all those other countries do is give moms, and in most cases dads, some guaranteed paid time off when they have a baby. Now, get this. I'm not making this up. Only 4 countries in the world don't guarantee at least some paid time off for moms. We're one of them. The other 3 are you ready for this? Swaziland, Liberia, and Papua New Guinea. That's it. Canada lets parents split a whole year off with pay. That's good for babies. Studies show paid family leave means healthier kids who learn better, socialize better, and get in trouble less. It actually saves tons of money in children's health costs, but we don't do it. I know exactly what you're thinking. Kids don't work, they don't pay taxes, and they don't vote either. So how about us grown-ups? How's our health? We try really hard. Do you know how much we spend each year on health care?
$1,200 a year.
$1,500 to $2,000 a year.
$300 a month.
It's more than $7,000 a year per person. That's $2 trillion, 2 Iraq wars. Soon, we'll be spending $1 out of every 5 on health care. 20% of that whopping GDP of ours for health care alone. What about other rich countries? What do they spend? About half as much as we do on average. Scrooges, aren't they? You get what you pay for. That's what my mom told me. That's what economics tells us. So we're obviously the healthiest people on the planet, right? No matter what indicator you look at, we don't match up. People in nearly every other rich country live longer than we do. Compared with Europeans, we're nearly twice as likely to suffer from chronic illness after age 50. You know, like heart disease or high blood pressure. We've got fewer doctors per person, fewer hospital beds, and 47 million people with no health insurance at all. You can think of our healthcare system as a roof, protecting us, gold-plated, but with 47 million holes. Oh well. We are number one in obesity. So let me get this straight. We've got the most expensive health care and the poorest health. Don't you hate it when that happens?
And also in these little chunks so that teachers, professors could also just show chunks, stop it, and have a conversation about it. But we're going to look at some more aspects of our economy in that regard. Before I go from on with this, does anyone have any questions or comments? I want to make sure that this is as participatory as we can make it. So any questions or comments? Was any of this information surprising? Mm-hmm. And if it was, what was most surprising? Was it surprising that there are only 4 countries in the world that don't provide guaranteed?
Yeah.
discussion of health, because it certainly is something we've been talking a lot about, particularly in terms of its impact on our economy. How many of you followed, at least loosely, the healthcare debate when it took place in Congress? Quite a few. And have some sense, I think, of the bill that came out. One difference is we will no longer have 47 million uninsured people. We will now insure about 32 million of the 47 million who are uninsured. We will not insure the 12 million estimated illegals in the country, and there are about 3 million other people who, for various reasons, won't be insured. But we will be covering most of the population with the new health care bill.
But you don't have to prove that you're not a United States citizen to buy insurance now, so won't that be?
No, you can buy. You can buy.
You'll be able to buy insurance.
You'll be able to buy insurance, yeah. But you know, they can not sell it to you as well, and you won't be guaranteed to get it. You can't automatically. They can refuse you, which they will not be able to do with other people. So that's a difference.
But won't there be a number of people who just simply won't be able to afford the compulsory insurance?
There will be, although there is quite a bit of help available for those people. Now, I don't want to get into super detail about the health care bill, it's certainly, in my view, not what it ought to be, but I will at least tell you my bias. I'm glad that we did it, although I think it's short of what we needed to do, but I think we had to take some steps. But I would say that, in my view, the problem with the health care debate in the United States, which took place, was that it was about health care. And that may sound completely like a non sequitur to you, but I'm going to talk for a little bit about why I think that's the case. How many, I'm just going to ask a little question. How many of you would prefer to spend the next year free of charge, convalescing in the best hospital in the world? And on the other hand, how many of you would prefer that to spend that year at home feeling pretty good? You're laughing. You all would rather be in the hospital, right? Okay. Well, that question has a point. The point is that the goal is not healthcare, not even gold-plated, not even the best imaginable healthcare. The goal is health, and that's what we do healthcare for. And the point, too, then, is that in some ways, we spend an immense amount of money on healthcare. And we could spend more, and we probably will, and not necessarily change in any serious way those numbers that you see in terms of where we stand in the world, in terms of virtually all of the health indicators that are out there, and we can talk about a few more of those. So we talked about in the film that healthcare is, in a sense, the roof of a house. So let's be getting all metaphoric here, and assume that health itself is a house. So I'm going to draw a very bad-looking house here. And, a window here, et cetera, and it's got a foundation here under the house, et cetera, the door. Anyway, so this is, let's pretend for a moment that this is our house of health, and that healthcare is the roof of the house. What is the roof made of in our country? If you had to be metaphorical, what would you say the roof of this house was made of?
Insurance.
I want a substance.
Something that'll last.
Oh.
Something
tiles.
Tiles, you say? Somebody says tiles. Now we're in the right direction. Somebody says tiles.
Dollars.
Any other ideas?
Screen.
Somebody said straw. Is it really made of straw? Do you know that we spend half of the world's healthcare budget?
Gold.
Half of that
gold, right?
It's made of gold. It is far and away the most expensive healthcare system in the world. We're going to be spending 20 cents out of every dollar on healthcare. This is platinum. This is gold. This is something real pricey, but it also has, still have 15 million holes right now. It's got 47 million. And so what we have decided to do is put duct tape on the holes, as many holes as we can, and try to keep the elements, the rain, the poor health, from getting in and messing us up. But if you make a roof, and we could make the roof all gold, we could cover it over completely, be very spectacular, it would cost a lot of money. But what happens if you have a gold roof on a house that has a poor foundation and poor walls? What might happen to it?
Collapse.
So what we have to do is think of health as a house and think in terms of what the walls and the foundation look like in our house. And what is the foundation? We talked about it. Where does it start? What's the foundation of our health? Any
diet.
Ideas? Pardon?
Diet.
Now let's get before diet.
Babies.
Babies. Kids. We start with children.
Prenatal care.
What we do with children. And so what are some of the things that we know we can do to make children healthy?
Vaccinate.
We're pretty good at that. Actually, as a country, we're pretty good at vaccination. That's one of the things we do pretty well.
Prenatal care.
But prenatal care, not as well, in comparison to many other countries. And again, the biggest difference, family. Mm-hmm. It's bonding. Giving mom's time, at least, and dads too, and most other industrial countries also have time for dads. In Canada, moms and dads can split this. So they actually have, we know that this has immense effects on health. It has to do with a whole lot of things. Canada knows that they save lots and lots of money on children's health care costs because they do this. Kids get less sick. Yes?
If family bonding is so important, why don't we go even further back than that and say, let's change our economic outlook so where we don't have to have two parents working to provide this lifestyle that we think we need.
That's a good point. We could do it that way, or we could have two parents working shorter amounts of time and who pays for
people to stay home and not work? Who pays them?
The tax laws.
Exactly. You.
Yeah, they usually people contribute into the system, but it is essentially various things in the tax systems of these other countries that pay for it. The point is, they pay a lot less in the long run because they do it that way. They pay a lot less. In most of those countries, and we'll talk about taxes a little later. I wasn't planning on talking about taxes tonight, but later we're going to talk about some of the ways we might do taxes differently so that we would feel that it was more fair and it covered some of the things that we do. But yes, most other countries don't have that same fear of taxes that we have in the United States, and they find it's efficient to do that. Yes?
Okay, so I've always thought that the major difference, that the reason that we have, that the United States has poor outcomes in things like maternal and child health is because although we are a rich country, we have a very large population of poor people. Mm-hmm. And so I don't see the connection between something like family leave and child health. To me, it seems like more of a question of just deprivation.
Well, deprivation is a big part of it, but that's one of the serious deprivations that happens, and it involves a lot of things.
It's not the person that can't get leave, it's a person who has no money because they have no job.
That's right. But many people also, we are also less healthy even for people who are better off than other countries are. In fact, if you are a wealthy American, your lifespan is about the same as a poor European. In fact, in every way, in what you're talking about, inequality hurts. And that's part of the second conversation in this. Actually, the third day we talk about the impacts of inequality. But it hurts, and it hurts everybody. And it actually ends up hurting us, even middle class kids and stuff like that. And we we see that kids that don't have this bonding opportunity tend to get in trouble more. They're less able to socialize when they get into school. They tend to be more obese. There are other kind of issues that happen. If you talk to people in public health, I think they understand both what you're saying, which is absolutely true, that inequality is a huge impact on so many of these things, but also that these steps we take early in this first couple of years of life, including bonding and that kind of need, are very important. But now let's talk about the walls of the house, and let's talk about the back wall. And somebody mentioned that. What are other things we know are good for our health? Somebody mentioned one. Diet. So diet, let's put diet here. And diet goes under, let's call this back wall the wall of lifestyle. This is something a lot of us talk about. You know, we talk about those. On the one hand, I think the Democratic Party talks very much about health care. And the Republican Party talks very much about individual responsibility for lifestyle. Now, both of these things matter, but they're only two parts of the puzzle. But what is it that we know about lifestyle that matters? What are some of the kinds of things in our lifestyle would make us live either longer or not so long?
Exercise.
What else?
Stress, obesity.
Okay, and obesity. Stress is going to be another one of the walls because it's so important all to itself. What are some of the things that tell us not to do?
Smoking.
Yeah. And the United States was the world leader in cutting smoking. I mean, that's another thing we did really well, and other countries are only now starting to catch up. It's only been in the last few years that there are some other countries in the world that smoke less than we do. Sweden, for example, Canada now, Norway. But that's pretty recent. The U.S. was definitely the first to do that. And of course, you shouldn't drink too much. We know that. A little bit's okay, but you don't want to drink too much. What else is important for in lifestyle?
Purpose.
Yeah, it's a little different issue, but we're going to get to that.
Sleep.
Somebody said sleep. Rest. Okay, so this constellation of things we will call lifestyle. And some people will say that's just a matter of personal responsibility. That's all our choices. We should just do the right thing. It's sensible to do the right thing, but the fact is that there are some things in our society that make it more difficult to do some of these things than is the case in other places. Number one, we get a lot of messages early on about diet. And we subsidize, in fact, to a great degree, some of the very things that are worst for us. We also, of course, use a lot of fast foods, all of these kind of things. We know that we do that. But why do we do fast food? Why is it fast? Why does it need to be fast?
Time.
Yeah, because, again, we have not as much time as other folks do. We are working many, many longer hours, for example, than people in Western Europe. Depending on the country, we're working 200 to 400 hours longer, about 200 hours longer each year than the Brits work, about 400 hours longer than those absolute slackers, the Norwegians and the Dutch. They work the shortest hours in the world. So, okay, so we've got lifestyle. Now, let's go to the back of the house, and somebody mentioned this factor regarding health. Stress, somebody said, right? You said stress. Okay. So stress is a big one. Stress is a really big one. And it affects us in many, many ways. I recommend for folks, if you want to read a really good and funny, really much funnier than me, book about this, read the book by Robert Sapolsky, who's a Stanford epidemiologist. His famous book is called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And it's an amazing look at stress and the things that cause stress. But what are the stressors in our society? We are more stressed. And as a result of stress, we're also much more medicated to deal with it and things like that. That costs the healthcare system. What are some of the factors that cost stress?
You said diet. I immediately thought of the young people who become bulimic and all that because of body image.
That's a real stressor. That's a stressor.
Yeah.
That's true.
Fashion and
expectations.
Body image.
We have. Yeah, there are particular, you know, expectations that are part of the fact that we are really a much, much more competitive society than many other societies. And that is a stressor because there are fewer winners and more losers. Yes.
Noise and interruptions.
Noise and interruptions are stressors, and they're increasingly stressors for everybody. The other people are suffering from those kind of things too. Yes.
Well, with all the downsizing, people are asked to take on the jobs of two or three people.
Often true.
Yeah.
Often
job
true.
Security.
Yeah, and it job security. So lack of security is a big stressor.
But also what she's saying, you keep doing more and more.
And again,
work.
More work. Okay, and overwork is a stressor. Or no work. Yeah. Or the opposite is a big stressor. Unemployment is also a big stressor. We know. Pardon?
Debt
is a stressor, and we have had serious issues with debt in this country. Until 2 years ago, our savings rate 2 years ago had dropped down virtually to zero. Yes.
Technology
is causing speed up of work and of, again, of the kind of expectations. All of these things are stressors for us. So we know that, yeah. Insecurity is a major stressor. We know that the growing huge gap between rich and poor, and this is again one of the impacts of inequality on health, is a big stressor. Sapolsky's work, Richard Wilkinson in England, a lot of the people have studied, for instance, what it does to have a very, very hierarchical society. And it is not the CEO who gets the heart attack. Generally speaking, it is the lower level functionaries who are working long hours, like the CEO, and reporting to the CEO who get the heart attacks. And the greater the gap, the more this occurs, the more stressors cause these kinds of problems. And so in response, we also get a great deal of anxiety. We deal with that with drugs and various other things. So stress relief is what the wall would be if it were strong. Stress is what the wall is trying to keep away. Let's go to this wall. What else do we know? What do we know is really, really important for our health? Really, really, maybe number one if you're in the schools of public health. The best thing you can do for your health. What is it?
Prevention.
Pardon?
Prevention.
What kind of prevention?
Be married.
Pardon?
Be married.
Be married.
Be married.
Ah, be married is a part. Is you're
social
getting
relations.
You're getting
social relationships.
Social relationships. Connection. So this is a wall of connection. And marriage is a part of it. You know that people who are married are somewhat healthier, although really, really bad marriages actually can be big stressors. But in general, we know that that's true. We know that family and friends and social connection and community are really, really huge. There's nothing better you can do for your health. The worst thing you can do for your health is to be lonesome. We know that you can take a room of people and you can release cold viruses into that room, and the number of people who will actually catch a cold has to do with actually the number and closeness of the friendships that people have in the room. So we know that people who do not have social connection, that their immune systems are weakened by this, and that they're going to be more. We do these kind of tests. It's amazing when you see these sorts of results. But social connection is huge. What affects social connection in our society?
Time
again. Again, we have less time to spend with family and friends. We now know, for instance, that the average American says that he or she has two friends that they can truly count on. A quarter of Americans say they have nobody. that they can count on. And this is why Holden, places like Holden are so important, because this is a place that builds community. It builds these kind of things. But again, you've got to have time in order to make these kind of connections. It takes time, time for family, time for friends. If we're rushing through life trying to get stuff and trying to pile things up and working constantly, then those social connections fail. And we go into a lot more about that, but this is pretty common knowledge. So now let's look at the fourth wall. So what else do we know kind of affects our health in many ways?
Yes. Clean air, water, and food.
So this is the environment.
The natural environment.
Yeah. The natural and the built environment, and particularly the workplace environment. Really huge. Now, we die from accidents in the United States at double the rate of Western Europe. Children die from accidents at double the rate of Western Europe, workplace accidents, things like that. And we allow our air to be at least twice as polluted in terms of the standards that we set for air quality and things like that. You can release about double the sulfur and nitrous oxides and things in the air, the particulate matter, all of those kind of things. We have weaker rules on these kinds of things, and we pay in many ways for this because we simply don't want to. And we have the same kind of things for everything about what goes into products. We allow, although we just passed some legislation on this, very important legislation, we have allowed an immense amount of toxics to be put into our children's toys. They're made in China. Junk in them. The same toys, though, that China makes cannot be sold in Europe. They cannot be sold there because the toxics are not allowed. Now, we're changing, and we're setting our rules, and this has been the activity, particularly of the group Moms Rising, which is a group of mothers, basically a million strong, who said, we don't want our kids' toys to contain all this kind of toxic stuff. So these are the, and I forgot on foundation, that too, one of the things on the foundation has to do even with how kids are treated in families, and this probably will come as a surprise to you as well, but we also have about triple the rates of child abuse deaths, and double the rates of accidental deaths. All of these things go into making those health statistics that you know about. So if we were to try to have an extreme makeover for our house, we might think about what are the kind of things we could do in our economy that would strengthen the foundation and strengthen the walls, that would give us, that would really encourage us to be able to exercise more, to diet, to eat differently, to do those things. We've done a lot of that on smoking, and that was the right thing to do. What kind of things might give us less stress? We also know that our lack of connection has meant that we've had hugely rising incidents of depression in the United States, which is a response to that. Today, Americans, who are 4%, 4.7% of the world's population, consume each year 66% of the world's antidepressants. Now that's a depressing thought. But think about
it. Antidepressant drugs.
So this is when we want to think about what the economy is for, I think we need to think about the fact that there are so many of these things that go in that we never question, that we never ask about why we're doing them. We simply say we do what we do because the economy requires.
Okay.
Well, now let's see. Do we have any?
Session's over.
I think the session's probably over.
Anybody have a match? You can light the candles in the middle.
Just go up on the porch and see if anybody's out there.
Well, let me bring this to
the last smokers for life.
No, keep going.
Yeah, you can keep going.
Can hear.
Yeah.
So we could do some things about the house, and we'll talk about more of those things, and they will cost. Somebody brought that up. Who's going to pay? They will cost, but they will cost ultimately less. This is the message. You know the old Midas line. You can pay me now, or you can pay me later. And we generally have the attitude that we don't want to pay for things up front. We want to do things the cheapest way, get the cheapest stuff, all of those kind of things, and you know, we'll deal with the consequences later. The consequences are immense. If you have 50% more likely, as you are in the United States, to suffer from these chronic illnesses in old age, think of the cost that that ultimately makes to the healthcare system. The state of California, for example, finds that about 80% of the cost of its hospitalization deal with exactly those things. So this itself is something that we really pay for, but we don't think about it. We don't think about, you know, the big picture of the economy. Now, in order to do that, in order to think differently about the economy, we probably need some different measurements than the GDP. And I think you saw that in the film, that GDP is a pretty, not a particularly good way to measure how well we're doing. It lumps everything together, the good and the bad. As long as you spend money on it, it's considered a good thing. But we do have some possibilities of new measurements, and lots of economists and lots of people are really thinking about this stuff now. President Sarkozy of France, who was elected actually as the conservative candidate in France, commissioned some of the top economists in the world to look at better ways to tell his country how well they're doing. And in the United States, we are on the verge of doing some wonderful things along these very lines, and they happen to be the result of one person who had a dream, an idea, and the craftiness and stamina to see it through. So a fellow named Chris Honing, I had the opportunity to meet him a little earlier this year. He worked at one time for IBM in a high management position. He worked for the General Accountability Office of the government. Before that, he had been a small businessman. And somewhere in his life, Chris Honing got the idea that GDP wasn't a very good measurement, and that we needed other ways to tell ourselves how we were doing. And he, on the side, even convinced his employers to allow him to use some of his time to try to develop a whole new system of key indicators for the United States. He did this very quietly. Nobody even knew it was happening. And he managed to get some foundation money from some large foundations to further his work. And he created the State of the USA project. And you can see the prototype that we will have available to us very, very soon at stateoftheusa.org. And this is a system of 300 indicators from everything from health to all kinds of things. And there are 20 health indicators alone that will tell us how well we're doing on some pretty important things. And from that, we'll find something like a dozen really key indicators that will be a substitution for GDP in telling us how well we're doing. Well, Chris Honing, when he got all his ducks in a row and figured it all out, he went to Senator Edmund Kennedy, and he said, I'd like you to put in a bill to make this new key indicator system for the United States. And Ted Kennedy said, and this was not long ago, shortly before Ted Kennedy died, Ted Kennedy said, well, if we try to put this in as a bill, it's not going to go anywhere. But what I'm going to do is attach it to the healthcare bill. One of the big indicators is health. And so Kennedy put in a section of the healthcare bill, which then passed the Senate by a 99-1 vote. The only dissenting vote was Tom Coburn of Oklahoma.
A doctor, yeah.
But here we are. So now in the healthcare bill, as it was passed, we are devoting $70 million over the next 8 years to really create this national key indicator system, which you will be able to find out anything you want. You'll be able to tap all kinds of things. You'll be able to get information and data on practically anything about quality of life, about inequality, about health, about all of these things, you'll be able to cross-tab this stuff according to race, gender, age. really doesn't like that. And it's a kind of exciting development. But let me bring this to a close because it's time anyway, and tell you just what we're going to do in the other sessions. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about what. Okay. This fits with what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. Made me happy that the light came on. So tomorrow our discussion is going to be, what if we design the economy to make us happy? And that's what, of course, Thomas Jefferson enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, that governments were instituted among men, they weren't very gender conscious in those days, in order to secure life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And people don't know that originally it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, or property. This was what Locke and Jefferson changed this to happiness. But right now, happiness science has become huge. And we'll talk about that tomorrow if you come, just how big this is and where it all started, particularly in an exotic place, the tiny Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. I'll talk a little bit about that. And we are now in the process in the city of Seattle of working, instead of gross national product or gross domestic product, we're in the process of trying to make Seattle America's first gross national happiness city.
Yes.
And to measure things according to those lines. We have the support of the city council for this, and we are moving forward. So, and you can do this in your town. It's fun. There's a lot of things to do. So that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow. Wednesday, we're going to talk about inequality, what we call what Pinchot would refer to as the greatest number, after the greatest good, the greatest number. How does everybody benefit from this? So we're going to look at inequality. Thursday, we're going to look at the longest run, and that's sustainability. How lasting is this for future generations, what we're doing, how it can be sustained. And then Friday, we're going to and really encourage a great group discussion about what some of the things are that we can do on the local level, on the national level, personally, within our companies and everything, if we want to make quality of life and happiness and fairness and sustainability the goals of our economic activity. So I'll be around here if you want to ask me questions or anything like that.
Great.
Thank you very much.